Hi, it's Diane. On my mind.
Let's start with Kurt Volker's deposition. How does he fit into this larger effort of building a case for impeachment?
It didn't take long for congressional committees leading the impeachment inquiry to turn up more details on the White House dealings with Ukraine. And the president pushes back.
This is a hoax. It's a witch hunt. It's a disgrace. Should have never happened.
I spoke with Joshua Geltzer, executive director of Georgetown University's Institute for Congressional Advocacy and Protection. I asked him to explain the showdown between the executive and legislative branches and what it all means for the impeachment proceedings. So yesterday, members of Congress heard from Kurt Volker. Tell us what they learned.
Well, they heard from him, and they seem to have received from him in text message form a lot of indications that, in fact, the president's Ukraine phone call was not a one-off. Instead, it was part of a long series of conversations with the Ukrainian government, trying to get the Ukrainian government to do two things, really, in exchange for U.S. support. One, look at the president's theory of what happened in 2016, the idea that the Ukrainians were the source of election interference, and two, reopen the investigation that had long been closed into Joe Biden's son.
And what role was Rudy Giuliani playing in those exchanges of messages?
Not a role one typically sees for essentially a private citizen or the personal lawyer of a president. He seems to have been integrated, in a sense, into the State Department apparatus insofar as he was in regular contact with people like Kurt Volker. On the other hand, he seems to have been pursuing the same basic agenda item of trading Ukrainian efforts to muddy the Bidens for U.S. support. He seems to have been pursuing that directly. That's not a role that private citizens are supposed to play.
How do we know that Giuliani was in direct contact with Volker?
We know that in part from Rudy Giuliani. He has been insistent in showing text messages and discussing on cable television the contact he had with the State Department. It seems that his agenda item right now is not being portrayed as a rogue actor. And so in avoiding that, he is bending over backwards to say, look, the State Department wanted me to do this, urged me to do this, and I did it with their knowledge. And regardless of the propriety of what he was doing, he seems to be right on that score.
So these text messages, in essence, are talking about what Giuliani wants from the Ukrainians, and he's saying it very bluntly.
Very bluntly. This is not coded language. This is not euphemisms. At times, these text messages say to the Ukrainians, look, your head of state gets a meeting with Donald Trump, the president of the United States, if there is a commitment to reopen the investigations that Donald Trump wants your country domestically to reopen. And why does he want it reopened? Well, we all know that, because he thinks he can vindicate a theory of 2016 that he regards as purifying his electoral victory, and probably even more so because Donald Trump sees Joe Biden as the main or at least a key political rival in 2020, and he wants dirt on him.
So is that a quid pro quo?
I think any prosecutor would look at the call memorandum released by the White House, would look at these text messages, and they'd think, I'll take this case. There's something here that we can work with. And of course, that's before you even get testimony from the people involved. Now, folks on the Hill got testimony from Kurt Volker yesterday. We don't know the full details of what he said, but there are people like Rudy who probably have a lot more to say on these issues.
So who else besides Rudy Giuliani do members of Congress want to hear from and why?
I would think they'd want to hear from the Secretary of State. Mike Pompeo initially seemed to suggest he was not witting, at least in real time, of the now famous Trump call with the head of the Ukraine, but later acknowledged quite explicitly that he was listening in real time. That is unusual in and of itself. Having worked in government, I can tell you it happens sometimes that the Secretary of State will listen in on a presidential phone call with a foreign leader, but it's not the norm, and especially a call being styled as a congratulatory call to not, let's say, China or the United Kingdom or one of our primary interlocutors. It's at least unusual, and it seems to fit media reporting suggesting that this call was a subject of consternation and interest at very senior levels of the government, precisely out of concern that the president might do exactly what he did.
How unusual was it for 11 or so other people to be listening in on this call?
It does happen that you have staff at the National Security Council listen in on a presidential call with a foreign head of state. If you think about it, when two heads of state talk, it's not just for their own benefit, it's so their staffs can turn around and implement whatever it is they agree to. That used to be our job, turn around and make good on the commitments, follow up on the outreach. Of course, that is less doable when the call memorandum gets stored on a system that it appears unnecessarily to have been used to store it, precisely out of a concern that people might realize what the president said on the call.
So if the Congress, as it has, threatens with subpoenas and the White House refuses to respond to those subpoenas, what happens next?
You litigate. That's the great American tradition in some ways. You go to court. And I say this as part of the legal team representing the House in the lawsuit right now against Don McGahn, who was served with a subpoena, asked him to show up and testify. The president wrote him a letter that said, don't go, and he didn't show up. And the House has gone to federal court and said, give us an order, force him to show up. Congressional subpoenas, they're not optional, they're not invitations, they're not voluntary, they are to be complied with. And this resistance across the board to providing pieces of paper and to allowing individuals, now private citizens in the case of somebody like Don McGahn, the ability to show up, that is a real problem for our constitutional design that includes congressional oversight.
Okay. On the one hand, we're concerned about our constitutional design. At the same time, what happens to a private citizen like Don McGahn if he simply follows White House orders?
Well, in this case, he gets sued by the House of Representatives, and ultimately, we hope there will be a court order that indicates that the arguments being made now by the Justice Department representing McGahn are not valid ones. And there's precedent for saying that those are not valid legal arguments. The Harriet Myers case, which was decided by a judge in the same court, the District Court for the District of Columbia, concluded that virtually the same arguments made back then by the Justice Department were not valid grounds for resisting a congressional subpoena. And ultimately, a court order is something that I strongly suspect virtually all private citizens will comply with, because otherwise they'll get held in contempt of court.
Eventually. But how long could all that take?
It takes time, and it's that time that seems to be frustrating many parts of the American public. It's that time that I think is frustrating some on the Hill. And in the litigation world, this is moving relatively quickly. It's on an expedited schedule. It's a matter of weeks, not months. But given the pace of news these days, even weeks seems quite slow.
So how could the refusal of really prime characters in this whole presidential drama, how could their refusal affect the ability of the Congress, the House, to move forward with impeachment?
It certainly frustrates Congress when it can't hear from people whom Congress believes and has good reason to believe could provide context, color, facts that would inform the ongoing impeachment inquiry. At the same time, what you're seeing is Congress gathering the facts that it can. And now shifting a bit from McGahn to the past couple of weeks, you see in Kurt Volker's provision of text messages, you see in the testimony he gave last night, a picture that's really filling out that suggests this was a deliberate effort directed by Donald Trump himself to use public office and the instruments of national power for private partisan benefit, namely increasing one's chances of re-election in 2020. And even with what we have, that's becoming a clearer picture.
What did Volcker agree to come forward as quickly as he did?
At least according to the reporting, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, pressured him or encouraged him to resign, as he quickly did. And I suspect Kurt Volcker wanted to be forthright at this point. He is a figure who is respected across Washington. He was George W. Bush's ambassador to NATO. He runs the widely respected McCain Institute, which tries to take a bipartisan approach. I suspect, and I think what some of those text messages show, is that he was trying to do a difficult diplomatic job and deal with some uncomfortable direction from the White House, perhaps the State Department. And ultimately, when I see that picture of him on his way to testify yesterday, I see someone who looks relieved to have gotten out of that role and to now be unburdening himself of what he saw. So I suspect he is eager to share what he knows, and then it's over to Congress to figure out what happens next.
Can you give me an example of the exchange between Kurt Volcker and those who were pressuring him to do something he really didn't think he should do?
Right. Well, there's one particularly notable exchange in which our highest-ranking diplomat to Ukraine says it's really inappropriate to have this kind of deal being negotiated in which a foreign entity, by the way, Ukraine is a foreign entity to which we want to provide certain forms of military support as a backstop towards Russian aggression, to tie that towards something that the president of the United States appears to want for political advantage. And that seems like an obviously true statement. The response that comes back from the U.S. top diplomat to the EU says, I think you're misunderstanding the president. There's no quid pro quo. Let's stop this conversation via this means. And sometimes the lady doth protest too much. It seems like our diplomat to the Ukraine had been tasked with doing something he understood quite well and was quite appropriately suggesting the impropriety in it.
I'd like to go back for a moment to the telephone call between President Trump and the head of Ukraine. Talk about whether we will ever see the full transcript of that call. The White House immediately put out its own version, which it said it felt was totally appropriate. Mr. Trump said, absolutely perfect call, good call. Tell me about that call.
Beautiful call, Trump even said, between him and Zelensky. So I'm not sure whether we are going to see or hear more. Having worked at the White House, I saw in that document the sort of record of a presidential phone call that one finds. Those tend to get initially taken down by folks who work in the Situation Room, folks who help to facilitate those calls, then sometimes corrected a bit by the policy staff that has expertise in the area. Sometimes they can recognize a name or a phrase given that expertise, and they are preserved roughly in that form. On the other hand, counter to what I just said is what the president himself has said this week, suggesting perhaps that that call memorandum didn't capture the full beauty, in his view, of the phone call. And so who am I to question whether there might be more there, as the president has indicated? But of course, what we all did read came from the White House, from Trump's own White House. And it allows all of us to look at that and say, is this a trade? Is this a deal of some sort? And is it drawing in particular on the context of 2016, it's Trump himself who puts this in an election context by saying he'd like more research done as to whether Ukraine was the source of election interference in 2016. And then the call pivots to 2020 and what can be done to help him going forward, not just looking backwards.
And then if the president was so willing to release this, let's say, summary of the phone call, why was it then put into this lockdown place?
Right, and the release is puzzling because there were many of us who, when we read it, thought that really does not look good for a presidential approach to just proper behavior, let alone good diplomacy. It seems that this is something of a strategy of this president. If you put out there things that most of us would regard as norm-busting, you normalize it in some way, and you signal to your political allies, here's the line we're holding. Insist that this is okay, and it will be okay. We saw that again later with the public calling by the president for China now to investigate the Bidens. And many scratched their heads and said, why would he double down on this notion of asking foreign governments to essentially smear a political rival? But I think the answer might be that is his MO. Try to normalize what seems unacceptable and signal, here's the line we're holding. There's nothing wrong with this anyway. It's in the open. It's a little bit like in 2016, Russia, if you're listening. If you do it in the open, somehow it defangs it, at least in Trump's view.
Is there a chance that the whistleblower will testify behind closed doors? And if so, can he or she ever be secure in keeping his or her identity secret?
My hope is that this conversation in some ways moves on from the whistleblower in particular to the really astonishing stream of information that has come out since that complaint was filed. You know, in some ways, the right way to think about a whistleblower's role in a system is not the jury that convicts, but the tipster at the beginning who says to the cops, look, I really think something is off here. I feel it's my duty to flag that, over to others to investigate, and certainly over to others to figure out the consequences and the remedies. And so I think we're at a point in that chain where it's really about figuring out testimony from others actually involved in the activities. Volcker was a start, but he shouldn't be the last one. And indeed, he is not the last one requested by House Democrats to show up and testify. And then, frankly, it's the job of folks on the House to figure out what this means for impeachment purposes. It is also the job of voters around the country to begin thinking about what it means for them as they consider 2020. And it may be the job for investigators in different parts of our government to figure out what improprieties they should be looking at.
Are you suggesting, or am I simply inferring, that you believe the whistleblower is now less important to this entire unraveling of the story than he or she was at the beginning?
I think that's right. Stories are supposed to move on from the initial complaint, that's the technical term, that triggers them. And at this point, I think what's key is to get those actually involved, Rudy being among them, perhaps the Secretary of State being among them, ambassadors who are implicated by text messages, getting those people to fill out the story, although the story is filling itself out pretty rapidly, and then to have Congress determine what it thinks those consequences should be. Of course, Democrats in the House suggest that the consequences are at least an impeachment inquiry, but that seems to me where we are in this progression here.
More from Joshua Gelter when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here is the rest of my conversation with Joshua Gelter. He is Executive Director of Georgetown University's Institute for Constitutional Advocacy. He was Senior Director for Counterterrorism at the National Security Council from 2015 to 2017. In 2017, you and some others started the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection, formed, I gather, to push back against executive power. What were you seeing at that time that worried you?
It goes right back to the 2016 campaign that Trump ran, in which he signaled that he would, if voted into office, do a number of things that pushed legal lines. That's not just a policy disagreement, that's legal lines.
Such as, what was he saying back then?
Now, some have not come to pass. For example, he said he would bring back torture. And thankfully, that seems at least latent or dormant, in part because there have been cabinet officials who have seemed to resist the president's call. But some of what he promised, he has done. So he said he would restrict immigration in new ways, regardless of whether he could get Congress to agree. Most recently, his administration issued a new rule that tries to guess whether those who are seeking to remain in this country lawfully will, in the future, take certain public benefits to which they would be legally entitled at that time, and based on that guess, deem them what's called in the law a public charge, and deny them even getting to the point of that lawful status to remain in the country. That's, in the words of the Department of Homeland Security, which issued this rule, an inherently subjective call. That's their own language in issuing the rule. Didn't stop them from issuing it. So we have represented a number of plaintiffs in suing the administration to stop that rule from going into effect. That strikes us as wildly going beyond what Congress allowed in the statutory regime governing immigration law, and frankly, beyond what the Constitution allows.
Do you believe that Donald Trump's presidency is challenging our Constitution as it now stands?
I really do. It's not just one or two policy areas in which he pushed the envelope and lawyers are disputing whether he's gone a little too far or not. It's across the board. He's stripping journalists of their press passes, it seems, for asking questions he doesn't like or finds too difficult or too intrusive. He is taking an end run around Congress when it won't approve money that he wants for a border wall and drawing from other pots of money to which he seems legally unentitled to draw to go ahead and build that wall. So this is not just one policy area. It's a sense that the executive can pursue agenda items, both politically and to some extent personally, and the law is an obstacle just to be avoided or plowed through. That is itself a disrespect for the rule of law that is unlike presidents of both parties in recent years before him.
So how is your organization acting to try to defend the Constitution and the constitutional rights of the people in this country?
We're going to court. We're going to court and suing, sometimes at least, the Trump administration or its departments and agencies for executive overreach. I mentioned the public charge suit. We've also filed in recent weeks a challenge to the administration's new rule for obtaining what are called diversity visas. And unlike for years, the administration has said that those who want to be in the lottery for these visas must acquire a passport before they're even entered. Now, a passport is extremely expensive, especially in countries in Africa, for example. And those who enter this lottery tend to first figure out if they've won the lottery before spending what can be weeks or even months of their salary to get that passport. Not only did the Trump administration do this, it didn't do this through the notice and comment procedure, which is standard for issuing a new rule like this. The administration claimed that's a foreign affairs exemption, but if anything, issuing this new rule seems to be a foreign affairs problem, not a foreign affairs solution. Many countries appear concerned that their nationals will have to first get a passport. So yet again, we did what we do. We went to court and we sued them. We've also been in litigation against the administration in trying to fend off a border wall from being built in Texas across the property of a historic chapel. And we'll keep using the courts as a check on executive overreach.
When you and your colleagues established the organization, did you ever envision anything as broad as what's happening now happening?
I think we knew that things were going to get interesting and worrisome, but it probably would be fair to say we didn't quite know how interesting or how worrisome. We knew that immigration would be an area in which the law would be pushed and tested. We knew in particular that national security and law enforcement concerns were going to be invoked in ways that we, as national security and law enforcement officials at one time in government, found inappropriate. But the full spectrum of challenges to the rule of law, especially some of those about free speech, free expression, especially those that involve using political office and the bully pulpit of the presidency to go at private citizens, private companies, vulnerable communities, that full spectrum, I'm not sure anyone fully anticipated that.
The charges that the president is making against former Vice President Biden seem totally false, and yet he continues and his supporters continue to point to Biden as corrupt for having gone after a corrupt attorney general in Ukraine. Explain this to me and how all these other countries were in support of the United States and then Vice President Joe Biden in going after that man.
It's sheer disinformation. The facts are that the vice president, as I understand it, among other countries, praised Ukraine for bringing in somebody who would be tougher on any corruption, not softer, but tougher on any corruption, and would investigate any corruption more assiduously, more aggressively. That's the opposite of the Trump narrative that somehow Biden was pushing for a prosecutor who'd be less tough. Ultimately, it's a disinformation campaign, and it's interesting because in 2016, what we as Americans faced was a disinformation campaign largely of foreign making. This is the idea of Russian election interference. It's documented at length in Volume 1 of the Mueller report. It's not totally foreign because you had domestic actors echoing it, amplifying it, picking up themes of it, but it at least originated, for the most part, outside our country. In 2020, we seem to have a domestic disinformation problem. It's some of the similar tactics of spreading known falsities until some people believe them, but it doesn't even require a foreign origin at this point. It's starting right here at home.
At its least, could the accusation that Joe Biden used poor judgment in allowing his son to take that position on the board of a company under investigation, of course, they didn't know that then, but a company in the Ukraine when, in fact, the United States was pushing to have one of its top investigators removed.
I suspect if you went back in time and asked the family to evaluate it, knowing how this has played out, perhaps they would look to be even cleaner, even more careful than they were. But it seems that the Trump narrative of what went awry is simply based on a misportrayal of not just the vice president, but really of American policy and Western policy as a whole towards Ukraine. And of course, the particular irony in this is that it is President Trump who has taken public office and used it to push personal benefit in ways that many of us are just stunned and concerned by. The idea that there is a benefit to him, his brand, his family members, and their various brands in the relationships that he's built and used across the world as president, that's quite palpable. This administration has been dinged numerous times by the type of government officials who are supposed to be a check on those sorts of improprieties. So the sheer irony of even taking this as a talking point, as an attack point by this particular president, I don't think it can be lost on us.
Josh, we haven't talked at all about Attorney General Barr and his role in this entire matter and that of the Department of Justice. What do you make of it?
Well, it's not quite clear how well justice comes out of, in particular, this drama of the whistleblower complaint. So there are a couple of parts of justice that seem to receive this from a couple different parts of our government. And in what at least appears from the outside, a quite hasty decision, the conclusion is reached that this is not criminal activity, or at least not even the basis for further criminal investigation. Now, there are many of us who look at the call memorandum and see in it the solicitation from a foreign national of a thing of value, that's the statutory language, thing of value, in connection with a federal election. That is unacceptable. That is a crime. But the Justice Department seems quite quickly to conclude that that's not worth even further investigation. And then there's another problem. There's a longstanding memorandum between the Justice Department and the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, that indicates at a lower standard that this sort of matter should be referred by the Justice Department for the FEC to take its own look. That does not seem to have happened here either.
So you look at the role of Bill Barr and you wonder whether he put his finger into the matter and said, not going forward here.
You have to wonder in part because the Justice Department has indicated that the Attorney General did not recuse himself. You don't know what role he did play, but you know that it wasn't nothing. And it seems to me any lawyer who sees that a transcript of at least a concerning phone call, and remember, by this point, the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community had deemed the whistleblower complaint urgent and credible. If you see your own name in that call memorandum, as the Attorney General must have, you recuse yourself. That's the easy call for a lawyer, I think for any professional, to make. And the Justice Department has indicated that he did not do that. That in and of itself invites the question you ask, which is, well, what role did he play? Then you add to that what we've learned in the past couple weeks, which is that it seems to be a real priority of this Attorney General to travel around the world trying to enlist foreign governments to participate in the ongoing investigation led by a former U.S. attorney, Durham, into 2016 and how the U.S. government handled its counterintelligence investigation of Russian interference. And while at one level asking foreign governments to cooperate with an ongoing investigation has a feeling of normalcy, here it feels quite strange that that would be such a priority that the Attorney General is personally meeting with foreign counterparts to urge participation in this, not to mention that it's unclear why that investigation is proceeding anyway, given previous Inspector General investigations into basically the same substance.
What about the release this morning of information about the president and the vice president in regard to the IRS? How does that fit in here?
I think it fits an emerging narrative of abuse of the organs of power, abuse of the parts of our government that are there to do the public's work for the personal interests of those politicians currently in power. That's, of course, the subject of the Ukraine debate. But as you say, it seems that it's a similar story to be emerging with respect to the IRS and at least the complaint that there was intervention there in audits of tax records that implicate the president. And that is a line that we must hold as a country, that the organs of power exist for all of us, but not for our elected leaders. And it's critical to have whistleblowers who note through proper channels when they see things of concern. It's critical to have inspector generals who then do the investigation triggered by that. And ultimately, it becomes up to investigators, potentially prosecutors, the Hill, and the American people to determine the consequences.
I wonder if you are worried, as I am, by President Trump suggesting or even calling for civil war.
Yes, I am worried. I do share that worry. You know, a president's words matter. They matter a whole lot. And this president's words have gotten integrated into the language, at least, of some very violent actors in this group. There was an excellent study by the New York Times looking at the language of the El Paso shooter and how much it mixed and mingled with some of the president's allies, both politicians and those in the media who recycle and often seem to anticipate and give him his talking points. Now, you can never draw a perfect causal chain between something that's been said and an act of violence, but there's clear danger to it. And for a president to use that sort of language, knowing that people follow him on Twitter, pick up on what he says, and sometimes appear to act on it, that just strikes me as irresponsible.
You've raised concern about, will Donald Trump leave office if he's defeated in 2020?
it shouldn't be something to be concerned about, but I think it has to be for Donald Trump, because this is the same person who, when he was a mere candidate, said at a debate with Hillary Clinton when asked if he were to lose, whether he'd acknowledge that loss, "Stand by, I like to keep people in suspense." No American should have to be in suspense about that. We have a tradition here that when you lose, when it's clear that you've lost, you accept that and the country moves on. Now, that was as a mere private citizen. Now, of course, he is in the Oval Office and he has shown many inclinations to use that office to entrench his political power. That is, of course, exactly what is consuming Washington right now in the context of some of the dealings with Ukraine and now other foreign governments. So, again, if he wins, he wins. But if he loses, it's part of this country's tradition to step aside and let democracy move on. And I think it's important to have voices, and in particular, Republican voices, saying that now and making it clear that whatever Donald Trump thinks he can test about different lines in the coming months, that that goes beyond anything he'd receive support for.
It's been quite a week of developments. You see much more to come?
It's a week that feels like a year in some ways, but I do think there's more to come, because each of these appears to be the beginning, not the end, of particular stories. When we first collectively read the call memorandum of that Trump call with Ukraine, we might have thought that was the story, but it turned out to be just a piece of the story. And we're seeing that with the text messages and with the Volcker testimony. Now we see that there were communications with Australia. There were public communications with China about a similar push to have some of the things Donald Trump would like done by foreign governments to serve his interests, at least as he sees them, in re-election pursued. So I think we'd be naive to say we're at the end of this story.
Josh Gelzer, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email to drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Urivlitker. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.